The only way I can describe the way I was feeling at that time was what someone must feel when they're in survival mode. That's the only way I could describe it.
If anyone was in survival mode that night, it was Mrs. Katinka, wasn't it?
It was around dusk on the 24th of May 2014 in Birkdale, Auckland, New Zealand. Blessie Gotinko had just finished up her shift at a local insurance company and had planned on getting the bus back home. The walk from the bus stop to Blessie's home was something that she feared. The streets were not well lit and walking alone could be quite daunting. As it transpired, Blessie had every reason to fear. She never made it home that night, and an interview with a neighbour would uncover that they had heard something very ominous. Blessie Gotinko was a 56-year-old mother of three who lived in Salisbury Road, Birkdale, in Auckland, New Zealand. Blessie absolutely doted on her children, Bea, Vincent and John, and her husband Antonio. Blessie and Antonio had been married for 30 years, after they met in primary school in Cebu City in the Philippines. They were also neighbours, and Antonio often joked that he had obeyed God's law, love thy neighbour. Antonio described Blessie as his best friend and referred to her as the light of the family's home. Blessie and Antonio moved from the Philippines to New Zealand. As Antonio commented, they thought that it was the safest place to live, and therefore, the best place to raise a family. Blessie was always immaculately dressed, and she really took pride in her appearance. As her daughter, Bea, said, she would never leave the home unless well presented. Blessie had worked at Tower Insurance for around 10 years, and she was a very dedicated employee. She had worked in various roles at the company, but she spent most of her time in her current position as an insurance consultant in the sales team. Blessie made friends in the company with ease. In fact, she had made a very best friend, Bahula Shah, who described Blessie as a very cheerful person, a very happy person. David Hancock, who was the company's chief executive, said that Blessie was a hard worker, and much like others described her, he said that she had a very sunny personality, which made her an absolute pleasure to have as an employee. The 24th of May 2014 started out like any routine day for Blessie. That morning, Bahula picked her up from her home to drive the 15 minutes to their office at Tower Insurance in Auckland. The plan for that evening was for Bahula to drive Blessie back home when they finished their shift at 5 p.m. However, Blessie volunteered to work late. At around 6:30 p.m, Blessie phoned up her son and let him know that she was going to be catching a bus from the Auckland CBD shortly after 7 p.m. The bus would drop Blessie off at a bus stop in Birkdale, and from here it would typically take Blessie around 6 minutes to walk home. It was something that Blessie had done numerous times, but it wasn't something that she necessarily liked doing. Blessie had confided in her friend beforehand that she was concerned for her safety when walking home from the bus stop. It's a common fear that a lot of women all across the globe share. When it's dark, you don't want to be walking along the streets alone, so you walk that little bit quicker. The area where Blessie got off the bus wasn't very well lit. And while it was a relatively safe area, every area can fall victim to opportunistic predators. Mark Schoenbeck, who lived nearby, recollected how he had recently been attacked in the area by two large men who wanted his iPhone. He suffered cuts and bruises, and police were never able to identify the two men. At around 3:15 a.m. the next morning, Blessie's daughter Bea arrived home after working the night shift. She was surprised and very concerned to find that her mother wasn't home. Blessie was a middle-aged woman and she liked to stick to routine. It was completely out of character for Blessie to just not return home from work and for her to be missing in the early morning hours. Well, it was unheard of. B Bea began her own search for her mother. Her first point of action was to try and trace Blessie's phone. She was able to trace it to a grass verge in Salisbury Road, just a stone's throw away from the family home. As she searched the area surrounding the phone, she found her mother's shoes in a state of disarray. Upon making the discovery, Bea immediately called police. Investigators made their way to the scene to file out a missing person report and search for any other clues which could lead them to Blessie. Near her phone and her shoes, they found other items which were identified as belonging to Blessie, including Tupperware containers that she took her lunch to work in. Investigators set up a cordon around the area, and they began knocking on doors in the surrounding area. They wanted to know if anybody had seen Blessie or had heard anything out of the ordinary. Based on the scene, it appeared as though Blessie had almost arrived home when she was intercepted by somebody or something. The first door that they knocked on was the door of Bill Fonia, who lived right beside where Blessie's items were discovered. He had something very ominous to tell the investigators. He said that at around 8 p.m, his 10-year-old daughter heard somebody screaming outside their home, followed by the sound of a car speeding off. She had been cooking dumplings when she heard a car driving up the hill from Eskdale, followed by a high-pitched scream from a woman, and then the distinct sound of a car speeding off. At the time of Blessie's disappearance, Antonio was in the Philippines on a work trip. He immediately made arrangements to return home to be with his children and assist in the search for his wife. The same went for Blessie's two sons. One lived in Australia while the other lived in Canada. They all rushed home so that they could be together during the tough time. Wanting to uncover more about Blessie's movements, investigators appealed to the public. They speculated that Blessie either got the 7:20 p.m. or 7:40 p.m. bus, which was the 973 or the 974. They wanted to speak to anybody who had travelled on either bus, neither of which had cameras. While those who had used hop cards for the bus could be traced, those who paid in cash could not. Detective Senior Sergeant Stan Brown said, "The circumstances of Blessie's disappearance and the location of some of her belongings give rise to serious concerns for her safety." He said that when Blessie was last seen at work, she was wearing a white top and light trousers. He described her as being of slight build, around 160 centimetres tall, and with dark shoulder-length hair. CCTV footage from Tower Insurance confirmed that Blessie had left the office that evening safe and well, at around 6:53 p.m. In addition to appealing to people who may have been on the bus with Blessie, Detective Brown also said that they wanted the public to keep an eye out for other items that Blessie would have had with her, including her distinctive Omega watch and her reading glasses. Many members of the community would dedicate their time into searching for Blessie. Some printed out flyers which could be seen stuck to almost every lamppost in the area. With the search underway, a Facebook page was set up by Bahula's daughter. They had hoped that it would draw information from members of the community. The search for Blessie focused on the area surrounding the ominous findings, but no other evidence which could hint towards Blessie's whereabouts was uncovered. Another angle that investigators were looking into was the movements of dangerous former convicts in the area. There was one man in particular that they knew of, a man that had an extreme propensity for violence. That man was 27-year-old Tony Robertson. Robertson had just recently moved into the community, and he had been kept under surveillance, which included wearing a GPS anklet and following a curfew. Robertson was living 1.4 kilometres away from Blessie, and 800 metres away from the bus stop she would have disembarked at. Robertson had an extensive criminal record dating back to when he was just a teenager. He had convictions of assault, aggravated robbery, possession of an offensive weapon, willful damage, threatening to kill, burglary and receiving. At the time of Blessie's disappearance, he had only just been released from prison after he had abducted and molested a 5-year-old girl. He had served 8 years in prison after being convicted in 2005 of abducting the girl with intent to sexually abuse her three charges of indecently assaulting her, the attempted kidnapping of two other children, and robbing a 12-year-old girl. In regards to the kidnap victim, he had lured the little girl over to his car with the promise of Christmas presents. He pretended that he was speaking to her mother on the phone and convinced her that he was a family friend. Once inside the car, Robertson drove the girl to an isolated car park. By this point, the girl had been reported missing, and a police officer showed up at the car park just in time. Robertson had removed the girl's clothing and taken down his boxer shorts. After his conviction, the parole board declined his parole in 2013, stating that he had not admitted to his offending, had shown no remorse, and that he remained a high risk. After serving his full sentence, he was released in September of 2013. He had strict special conditions imposed on him, which prevented him from having contact with anybody under the age of 16 or going near schools, parks, or playgrounds. He was also required to wear electronic monitoring. Since then, he had breached his release conditions twice. In January of 2014, he was sentenced to 6 months community detention for breaching his conditions. Later that same month, he was arrested after going to a park. By February, an extended supervision order said that he would be monitored for up to 10 years by court because he was deemed a danger. Justice Edwin Wiley had written, "I am satisfied that Mr. Robertson poses a very considerable risk indeed. I consider that it is likely he will commit an indecency on a child under the age of 12 years, and that he will abduct a child for the purpose of sexual connection. The evidence compels the conclusion that he is impulsive and that he is unable to control his anger and aggression. Mr. Robertson has a proclivity towards sexual offending. He has shown no remorse. Indeed, he continues to deny it." After breaching his release conditions, Detective Sergeant Pete Blackwell raised his concerns that Robertson was dangerous and it was only a matter of time before he attacked somebody. He stated, "He is the offender that I have very, very serious concerns about his reoffending." His record was certainly ominous, and investigators decided to check his GPS monitor. Detective Constable Chris Cooper contacted the Corrections-run GPS service that monitored Robertson. His GPS monitor showed that on the evening that Blessy had vanished, he had been driving around the North Shore. He then went to Glenfield Cemetery, which was less than 1 kilometre away from where Blessy vanished and 1.6 kilometres away from where she lived. Based on the speed that he was moving, Robertson was in a car driving on the road where Blessy had vanished from, around the same time that she vanished. Then in the early morning hours of the next day, Robertson returned to the cemetery. The movements did seem somewhat suspicious, so investigators decided that they would go down to the cemetery. The movements could have been completely innocent, but investigators didn't really have anything else to go on, and Robertson was a dangerous individual, and he was in the area at the time. Investigators descended on the scene with the assistance of a rescue dog team and flashlights. It was a dark and cold night. As they entered the cemetery, one of the dogs directed them over to a bush. There was something in the bush that really captured the interest of the dog. Senior Constable Gary Learmouth recoiled in horror as the dog put his nose into the bush and grabbed a human foot. As the investigators pushed away the leaves and vines, they found a woman's body. She was wrapped up in a fawn-coloured sheet and hidden beneath a pile of scrub in the bush. There was blood seeping through the sheet and the woman's clothing. Investigators set up a police cordon around the cemetery, as the body was transferred to the medical examiner's office for a cause of death to be determined and for an identification to be made. As the search at the cemetery continued, traces of blood were found, which indicated that the woman had been dragged through the cemetery, through the long grass and bush, to where she was found. Luminol was sprayed to find probable blood areas, and it uncovered a trail of blood. The likely scenario that investigators deduced was that the woman had been taken to the cemetery by car, and then dragged to the spot where she was disposed of. There were also partial shoe prints, presumably from the killer. The following day, the woman was identified as Blessie. She had met a violent end. Her leg had been broken in two different places. There was evidence that she had been strangled and she had been stabbed before her throat had been slashed. As per her autopsy, there was evidence that Blessie had struggled while being strangled. Her shirt was completely stained with blood, and her tongue had been injured. This was evidence that Blessie was still alive when her throat was slashed and when she was stabbed. It was estimated that it would have taken Blessie minutes to die. The attack on Blessie had been brutal. There was a large gash across her cheek and neck, which had left her jawbone exposed. The gash was 14.5 centimetres long and 2 centimetres deep, and it had cut through her windpipe. There were several stab wounds, blunt force injuries, and even damage to her spine. She had broken ribs, broken legs, broken or missing teeth, and abrasions to her body that were consistent with post-mortem dragging. In regards to the strangulation, she had bruising to her neck, a fractured thyroid, and broken capillaries in her eyes. Blessie had suffered tremendously. At around 5 a.m. that morning, a team of police officers executed a search warrant at Robertson's Monte Cassino Place apartments. His neighbours were awoken by the sound of a loud banging, followed by shouting. As they peered from their windows, they saw the team of police officers using a steel battering ram to enter the apartment. Once the door was bashed in, they were met by an extremely loud scream. They followed the source of the scream and found Robertson hiding underneath a sleeping bag on the couch. As Detective Sergeant Todd Bartlett commented, "He certainly wasn't asleep. Whatever he was doing before that, I don't know." Robertson was handcuffed and escorted from the apartment. He was completely wrapped up in a white suit with a hood pulled tightly over his head to conceal his identity from any prying eyes. A couple of hours later, he was charged with the murder of Blessie. Back at his apartment, the search continued. A silver BMW that belonged to Robertson was seen being towed out of the street. According to neighbours, just the day after Blessie vanished, the car had a smashed windscreen, and a man came out of the apartment to fix it. Mike Nelson, the auto windscreen worker, had been called out by Robertson urgently. He noticed that there was some blood on the windshield. Robertson commented that he and his friends had been trying to impress some girls when one of them slipped on the bonnet of the BMW and put his backside through the windshield. Inside the car, he also noticed blood. Robertson commented that he had cut his hand. Investigators would tow away the BMW and find traces of blood inside, including in the back seat. In addition to the BMW, investigators removed some other potential evidence, including a bloodied knife. In the backyard, investigators set up a tent as they excavated. They were looking for any more evidence that could connect Robertson to Blessie's murder. They found her handbag, and in a nearby wheelie bin, they found bloodstained towels and mop heads. It was apparent that Robertson's apartment was a crime scene. News quickly spread throughout the area about the grim discovery of Blessie's body and the arrest of a suspect. The murder completely stunned the nation, where such random attacks are relatively rare.
I've recently just come back from a road trip around the Baltics. I knew that I was going to be extremely busy each day, so I decided to bring along with me some bottles of Magic Mind, the world's first productivity shot. It's just slotted in perfectly to my morning routine. As somebody who is obsessed with coffee but trying to cut down, Magic Mind has helped me cut down on the caffeine. Each little bottle of Magic Mind contains 12 active ingredients designed to stimulate focus, creativity, energy, and motivation, as well as decrease stress. Usually by the afternoon, I feel deflated and I struggle to concentrate on my writing. Even when I've got everything in front of me, the case files, the information from the archives, I'm just not feeling inspired to write. Well, since drinking Magic Mind each morning, I'm motivated and energized throughout the day. Also gone is the mid-afternoon crash from caffeine and the jitters. I don't need to drink more and more coffee to get me through the day. One shot of Magic Mind in the morning, and I'm good to go. It's also an added bonus that Magic Mind comes in the most unique little bottles, with amazing packaging, and it tastes delicious as well. Seeing how well Magic Mind has worked for me, I really would encourage you to check it out. Just head to magicmind.co/morbidology to get a limited 40% off subscription and 20% off a one-time purchase offer. The 40% code is for the next 10 days only, so get on over to magicmind.co/morbidology and use the code morbidology for 40% off. While I have identified Robertson already in this episode, his name was actually suppressed from the media. The public knew that somebody had been arrested and knew where he had lived, but very few knew his identity. And it would remain that way for quite some time, much to the dismay of Blessy's family. Members of the community gathered outside Robertson's apartment and the cemetery, where they chatted amongst themselves and to the media. Tracy Flaws, who lived on Birkenhead Avenue, said to the Southland Times, "You just don't expect this in little old Birkenhead. It's a tight community. Everyone sort of knows everyone. My daughter knows Blessy's daughter." Grief counselling was offered at Tower Insurance, where Blessy was a member of the 40-person team. Blessy's colleagues spoke about holding a memorial for her, with her friend Vanessa Dudley commenting, "She's been here 10 years, so everyone has got stories to tell. She is the one who always made them laugh. She always had something positive to say." In a true testament to the kind of woman that Blessy was, customers frequently called Tower Insurance to pass on their condolences. Over on Facebook, the atmosphere was somber. Those who knew Blessy flocked to the Facebook page that had been set up to share their fond memories and speak of the overwhelming sense of loss. Her colleague, Serena Kirkwood, wrote, "Blessy always warmed my day with her sweet, friendly nature when we worked together." All of Blessy's family came together at the home to try and make sense of the tragic revelation. Vincent and John briefly came outside the home on Salisbury Road to thank the neighbours for their help in searching for Blessy and for the compassion that they had shown them. Antonio would state that he and the rest of the family had been overwhelmed by the outpouring of support from the community. New Zealand police released a statement on Antonio's behalf, which read in part, "Right now we are just trying to pretend that everything is okay. But deep down we are broken-hearted. We have been robbed. She has gone too soon." Shortly thereafter, the family would gather outside the home and speak publicly. Antonio said, "Personally, on behalf of my family, I would like to thank the media people in New Zealand for all the concern, the sympathies, and all the publication that my wife has received. My wife is a very private person, and overnight she became a sensation. And I don't think she's going to like it, but I'm sure she's happy. It really helped the case." Antonio said that the family's strong faith was helping them get through the tragic ordeal, and shared his belief that everything happens for a reason. He said he believed that Blessy's purpose was to awaken the country to the notion that the environment was changing, and that people needed to start making an effort to protect their neighbours. He said he wanted the world to know that Blessy was a good person, a good wife, a good mother, a good grandmother, and a good friend. Antonio also said that Blessy would want the family to be strong, but they were in darkness. He commented on New Zealand, and said that despite what had happened, he still believed that New Zealand was a wonderful and safe country. He stated, "In fact, I kept on bragging overseas that New Zealand is very much better in terms of safety and security than the Philippines. But it just happened to us." The day after the arrest, Robertson appeared in court, where he was granted name and image suppression. Judge Philippa Sinclair said that a fair trial would be jeopardised otherwise. No bail application was made, and Robertson was remanded into custody as the investigation continued. The community would come together to hold a candlelit march in memory of Blessy. The turnout was absolutely massive, with around 2,000 members of the community showing up and taking part. The march began at Birkdale Primary School. Blessy's family were there, and once again they were blown away by the support of the community.
Antonio said to the crowd. I never expected this size of a crowd. I think some of you are even coming from distant places. Thank you very much. I'm sure Blessie is watching us all and she is very happy. Those in attendance wore green, Blessie's favourite colour, as they released balloons and lanterns into the sky. They ended the march at the cemetery where Blessie's body was found. Here, priests and a local kamatua performed a blessing. Blessie's family did not continue to the cemetery, as they weren't quite ready to go there yet. The following week, Blessie was to be farewelled during a Requiem Mass. According to Father Craig Dunford, a Requiem Mass for Catholics was the greatest honour that they could pay. It was being held at St. Mary's Catholic Church, which was where the family had been members. Father Dunford said that Blessie was now part of the communion of saints. Blessie's body was cremated along with her picture, and her ashes were going to be placed in the church until the funeral, so that people could come and pay their final respects. Before this, Blessie's family had said goodbye to her in private, before the community were invited to bid her farewell. Antonio explained, it's a Roman Catholic ceremony mixed with a Filipino cultural tradition. It's sort of an open house. People can come and go and pay their last respects. Antonio said that the family had considered the entire thing being private, but they really wanted to take into consideration the feelings of the community, who had all been moved by the tragic case. The family had also been conducting a 9-day novena prayers, which is a Catholic ceremony to bless the soul of the deceased. After the viewing, Blessie's funeral was held at the church, and it was filled to the brim. It was described as a celebration of Blessie's life, and Father Dunford told her family that there would never be a time where she did not exist, and reminded them that one single act did not diminish the many acts of goodness. And the community had certainly shown many acts of goodness in the wake of Blessie's murder. At the front of the church lay Blessie's ashes, surrounded in photographs of the mother of three and bouquets of flowers. In a eulogy by her oldest son, John, Blessie was described as simply the best. He said that his mother was a devoted mother who had lived for her children. He described how her murder had left a massive void in their lives, a void that could never be filled. Her murder was something he described as a cruel blow. He stated, if a person's life can be valued in the aftermath of their passing, then my mother, during the course of her stay here on earth, had won so much love from so many people, she was truly worth her weight in gold, and then some. As Father Dunford presented Antonio with his wife's ashes, the couple's children broke down in grief. It was an extremely poignant moment. They placed the ashes into the back of their car and drove off for a private burial. On the 16th of June, Robertson appeared in court for a suppression ruling. As Justice Tim Brewer spoke, Robertson had an angry outburst and needed to be removed from the courtroom. It was ruled that the name suppression would remain. He also set a trial date for March of 2015. During the court hearing, a number of supporters of Blessie protested outside. They held signs which read, Justice for Blessie and shame on the judicial system. They felt like it was a slap in the face that Robertson was being protected by the suppression ruling. Shortly after the controversial court appearance, Robertson was additionally charged with sexual violation. As it was discovered, Blessie had been raped and sperm that was recovered had come back as a match to Robertson. Then in March, the murder trial was pushed back until April. During opening statements, New Zealand finally learned the horrific details of Blessie's last moments on Earth. Prosecutor Michael Walker described how Blessie had gotten off the bus safe and well, but as she walked home alone, Robertson had sped up behind her and run her over. Blessie had broken her leg in two places, but Robertson didn't leave her to die on the street. Robertson bundled Blessie into his car, drove to his nearby apartment, where he raped her. As mentioned earlier on, neighbours of Robertson said that he had a smashed windscreen, which was a horrific indication of just how quick he must have been driving. The force of hitting Blessie was enough to smash the windscreen. The pain that Blessie must have been in is unimaginable. But Robertson wasn't done. After raping Blessie, he launched a frenzied attack. He strangled Blessie, slit her throat, and then stabbed her multiple times with a knife, which had ultimately caused her death. He said to the jury, "The small petite woman, already injured from the first assault, stood no chance against the defendant armed with a knife." While presenting his opening statements, defense attorney Timothy Brewer asked the jury of 7 men and 5 women to focus on the facts that were presented and urged them not to be affected by emotion. He acknowledged that this would not be an easy task given the fact that Blessie was an innocent woman who'd been abducted, raped, and murdered by a stranger. He told the jury that at the time of Blessie's murder, Robertson had been wearing a GPS tracking device, but encouraged them not to look too much into that. Prosecutor Walker also commented on this, saying that the fact that Robertson had gone to the cemetery earlier on in the evening was important, because they believed it showed that Robertson had been planning to kill somebody. He stated, "His trip to the cemetery was scoping out where to dump the body. While Robertson's name was still suppressed, the judge had taken the unusual step of allowing the media to publish photographs of him, but not disclose his name. It was quite an unheard-of move." On day 2 of the trial, Robertson ditched his legal team and decided instead to represent himself. When he was called to present his opening statement, he appeared to change his mind. He apologized for mucking the court around, but said he needed more time to prepare. His request was denied, and he proceeded with his opening statement. He claimed that Blessie's death was an accident. He stated, "Will there be witnesses who saw this alleged deliberate running down? No, there won't. Will there be witnesses who will support the defense case that it was an accident? Yes, there will. Their evidence will show that I panicked and put her in my car and drove straight home to comply with my curfew." Robertson's curfew meant that he needed to be at home between 8 p.m. and 6 a.m. Among the handful of people who testified was Bea, Blessie's daughter. A screen was placed between her and Robertson so that she didn't have to look at the man who stood accused of killing her mother. She recalled her fondest memories of her mother before talking about the moment she discovered she was missing. Some colleagues of Blessie also testified to her movements of that day. Mike Nelson, the auto windscreen worker, also testified and told the jury that there was blood on Robertson's smashed windshield and blood inside the car. The jury would also hear some evidence in relation to Robertson's car. In addition to the smashed windscreen and the blood, there was damage to the bonnet and bumper. It was fresh. The majority of the rear passenger seatbelt was missing, and it was discovered that it had been cut. There were cuts and scratches to the leather seating in the back, and a large portion of foam from the seating was removed and replaced with foam from inside a pillow. Sergeant Blair Atkinson of the Sirius Crash Unit would testify next. He had completed a forensic mapping of the street where Blessie had been run down. He said that his findings showed that a car had mounted the curb and knocked her over. Under cross-examination by Robertson, however, he admitted that looking at the placement of Blessie's discarded items that were found nearby, it was unreliable to determine the point of impact from the crash. He accepted that there was nothing in the evidence to show specifically that the defendant's car had veered off the road. Robertson's neighbour, who lived in the apartment above, would tell the courtroom that on the night that Blessie was killed, he had heard loud thumping music coming from Robertson's apartment. According to the prosecution, this was to conceal the sound of Blessie being raped and murdered. The trial would then focus on Blessie's cause of death, with the pathologist Dr. Carl Wigren detailing her injuries. He explained that Blessie was still alive when she was stabbed and when her throat was slashed, telling the jury, "Blood had been inhaled, or aspirated, into the deepest part of the lungs." Blessie had died from a combination of her injuries: blunt force trauma from being ran over, strangulation, and knife wounds. Dr. Wigren also commented that the injuries Blessie had sustained from the vehicle collision would not have been enough to kill her. He said that there were no injuries to Blessie's genitals, but that did not exclude the possibility of rape. The findings at autopsy would be contradicted by defense expert Dr. Robert Chapman, who tried to suggest that there was no evidence that Blessie had been strangled. Despite the fact there was bruising to her neck, a fractured thyroid, and broken capillaries in her eyes. In regards to the evidence found at Robertson's apartment, it was also disclosed that a large filleting knife with a somewhat bent blade was found inside the kitchen, and it contained blood. There was blood found on a broom and Blessie's handbag, which had been buried in the garden. There was blood spread across the walls, tiles, door handles, light switches and the shower in Robertson's apartment. Forensic expert Fiona Matheson said that it was likely that somebody had walked around the apartment and then showered blood off themselves. She suggested that Blessie had been killed in the BMW, in the garage. She said, the extent of the blood staining indicated that Blessie may have been in the right back of the car when some of her incision damage was inflicted. There was heavy clotted blood in the car and incision marks in the back seat made by slashing movements. Robertson would suggest during the trial that the evidence had been tampered with. He said that the blood on the knife must have been planted there. Detective Robert Taylor staunchly refuted this. The defence would then call on Junior Anu, who revealed that on the night that Blessie died, he had to swerve to avoid hitting her. He said that Blessie had been standing in the middle of the road, looking at her mobile phone, when he swerved to avoid her. He said that he was being tailgated by a BMW, but after almost hitting Blessie, the BMW was not following him. Testimony would then be presented regarding the semen sample recovered. Forensic scientist Fiona Matheson said that semen was detected on genital swabs and samples taken from Blessie's underwear. Under cross-examination, she admitted that there were very few sperm heads present in the samples and said it was insufficient to give a DNA profile of the man involved. She did say under cross-examination that it was theoretically possible that the semen on Blessie's body could have been transferred from Robertson's bedsheet, which she had been found wrapped in. She also said it was theoretically possible the semen transferred from the backseat of his BMW, which could have had pre-existing semen stains. Her testimony was followed by testimony from forensic scientist J. Shri Patel, who said that there was strong scientific support that semen had in fact come from Robertson. She said that analysis did reveal a male DNA profile, and further examination showed it was 280 times more likely to have come from Robertson or a member of his family. Another forensic expert, Susan Vinter, testified. She had compared Blessie's DNA to that of the defendant and said that further semen testing revealed that it was 30,000 million million times more likely to have come from Robertson and that blood in his apartment was 400 million times more likely to have come from Blessie, while the blood in Robertson's car was 10,000 million million times more likely to have come from Blessie. Robertson would testify during the trial as well. He said that he had accidentally ran Blessie over while he was high on P and searching for drugs. He said, I was just absolutely freaking out. I opened up the back passenger side of my door and wrapped Blessie up and placed her into the back seat of my car as gently as I could. I was convinced that she was dead. I drove back to my house. He paused and stared at the ground before admitting, I stabbed Blessie. He described cleaning up the bloody mess and then disposing of Blessie in the cemetery. He added, I didn't rape Blessie. He said that the knife found in the kitchen was not the knife that he had used to kill Blessie, but instead, a different knife that he had buried. This is why he had accused the prosecution of planting the blood on the knife. He went on to speak about his life before the murder of Blessie, revealing that his girlfriend had a miscarriage 3 months into her pregnancy, and that his mother had a stroke shortly thereafter in 2014. He began to cry when asked how this had affected him, before stating, I tried to block it all out, smoking drugs all day. It stopped me from feeling like I feel now. He said that after these tragedies, he became addicted to drugs. CBD isn't about what you feel, it's about what you don't feel. Stress, anxiety, and pain. Feels is a better way to feel better. Feels offer premium CBD that can keep your head clear and your mind fresh. If you weren't aware, CBD has been proven to reduce anxiety, pain, and even sleeplessness. They deliver premium CBD right to your doorstep, and they even have a free CBD hotline for all you people who are new to CBD and have some questions. For me personally, Feels CBD has helped me with my insomnia. Gone are the nights of tossing and turning, and each morning I feel refreshed and ready to take on the day. It's also helped me with anxiety, and I take it on vacation with me to help me get through those travel worries that sometimes creep up unexpectedly. Just place a few drops of Feels under your tongue and feel the difference within just minutes. You can even get their new CBD-infused mints for a clear-headed feeling. Start feeling better today with Feels. Become a member today by going to feels.com/morbidology and get 50% off your first order with free shipping. That is feals.com/morbidology to become a member and get 50% automatically taken off your first order with free shipping. feals.com/morbidology. He then spoke about the stabbing, telling the courtroom, "I jumped out of my body and something else took over." He said that because he was high on methamphetamine, he wasn't thinking straight. He then turned to Blessy's loved ones and said, "I'm just real sorry. I know it doesn't mean anything." He claimed he thought that Blessy was dead when he stabbed her and wanted it to look like she was the victim of a random attack. When he was asked how his semen got inside Blessy and on her underwear, he replied and suggested it was put there by police malpractice. Under cross-examination, prosecutor Kieran Rafferty said that no drugs were found in Robertson's home, despite the fact he claimed that he was a daily user. He also pointed out that Blessy had stab wounds to her back, which countered Robertson's claim that she was passed out in the back of his car. He said that for her to be wounded in the back, she had to be moving or had to have been moved by Robertson. He replied that he wasn't sure because he had looked away while stabbing Blessy. Robertson also suggested that he went into survival mode.
Being her.
The only way I can describe the way I was feeling at that time was what someone must feel when they're in survival mode. That's the only way I could describe it.
If anyone was in survival mode that night, it was Mrs. Katinka, wasn't it?
You can take what you want from my answers, bro. I don't give a fuck, man. I fucking told you what happened, bro.
During closing arguments, prosecutor Kieran Rafferty accused Robertson of intentionally seeking for somebody to rape and kill. He refused Robertson's claims and said that a witness had heard Blessy scream after being hit by the car. If she screamed, then Robertson would have known that she was still alive. He said his semen was found inside her vagina. That, more than anything else, tells you why she was taken to that garage. Because he wanted to have sex with her. I did not accuse him of necrophilia, because she was alive when he raped her. Closing for the defence, attorney Chris Wilkinson-Smith asked the jury why anybody would plan a murder while being GPS monitored, or carry out their plan just minutes before they needed to be home for their curfew. He said that the stabbing was a panicked attempt to cover up what had happened, adding, he thought he was stabbing not a living person, but a dead body. As Justice Timothy Brewer was summing up the case and guiding the jury through the evidence, Robertson leapt out of his chair at the defence table. He began to swear and shout as he ran towards the cell next to the dock. He was escorted from the courtroom. The jury would deliberate for just 3 hours before returning with a verdict. They found Tony Robertson guilty of the murder of Blessy Katinko. Outside of court, Ruth Mooney spoke on behalf of Blessy's family. She said that they wanted to remember Blessy for who she was and not the evil that had happened. The verdict came around the 1-year anniversary to Blessy's murder, and the family said that they would be holding a celebration for her life. The sentencing phase was to follow, but before that, Tony Robertson's name was finally revealed to the public. The Supreme Court dismissed his application to appeal a court of appeal decision, refusing continued name suppression. With his name released in the media, his prior crimes were also revealed. When his past was brought to the surface, New Zealand was horrified and the community demanded answers as to how the murder of Blessy was free to happen. Robertson had been under supervision and there had been concerns about the dangers he posed. Politicians and principals at local schools questioned why Robertson was allowed to live so close to schools. There were three schools within walking distance of his apartment. Birkdale Primary principal Adrian Moyer said, "I was not ever made aware that a man known to authorities had moved into an area and lived near the school. In fact, many demanded a full inquiry, with New Zealand First leader Winston Peters announcing, "Someone has to be responsible for this man ending up where he did. The system has obviously failed. There has to be a full-scale inquiry. The public demands that." 3 months before Blessie was killed, a prison psychologist had described Robertson as high risk and likely to abduct and rape somebody. They profiled him as a violent offender with poor impulse control and deviant sexual preferences. When he was released, he had taken no programs in prison to assist rehabilitation. A review found that authorities had done all that they could to protect the public under powers that were available at the time. There were calls for a new law which would allow judges to revisit a dangerous offender's sentence at the end of their prison sentence. And then if they are deemed to still be a danger to society, then that sentence could be increased. A review into how Robertson was handled by the Corrections Department found that he had been handled in an appropriate and responsible manner. It found that incidents of non-compliance with Robertson's release conditions were swiftly followed up, and have resulted in 2 periods where he was held in custody. Corrections Region Commissioner Jeanette Burns said, "Sadly, however, no amount of supervision, rehabilitation or tracking will deter an offender who is determined to commit a crime no matter the consequences." When Robertson was convicted of the earlier sex crimes, the judge could have locked him up indefinitely, but the judge had showed mercy on him. Justice Patrick Keane had said, "You're not simply to be assumed to be a lost cause at the age of 19. This was something that Robertson's own grandfather opposed. Douglas Robertson commented of his grandson, "I believe that fella needs euthanizing." A lot of questions had been raised in regards to how Robertson had breached his parole twice, yet remained free among the community. While the Corrections Department did their own review into how Robertson was handled, it was announced that an independent review would be launched. Blessie's family were extremely grateful for the decision, as was the community, whose confidence had been shattered in the justice system. With the review underway, the sentencing phase for Robertson was held. Victim impact statements were presented. John, Blessie's son, said, "My mother was the greatest person I've ever known. She epitomised everything that is good in the world. I can only hope her passing was not in vain and she does not become another statistic." Her husband of 30 years, Antonio, said that the senseless and brutal murder haunted him constantly. He said he had forever lost the opportunity to celebrate birthdays, share meals, and tell his wife that he loved her. He said that it constantly dwelled on him how in love he and Blessie were, and questioned how something so horrific could happen to good, ordinary, faithful people who were leading honest lives. He stated, "Blessie was our guiding light, the centre of our home, and the glue that bonded us together. He did not have the right to viciously rob my children and I of our loving mother and wife." Tony Robertson was sentenced to life in prison with a 24-year minimum no parole period. He was also given preventative detention with a 10-year minimum no parole period for her rape. While the sentence was a relief, Blessie's son John said that there were no winners in the case, just shattered lives. In handing down the sentence, Justice Tim Brewer said that he accepted the prosecution's theory that Robertson had been seeking a female to abduct when he saw Blessie. He stated, "It was a bestial action, and it was committed with the intent that your victim would not survive." Shortly after the sentence was handed down, Robertson tried to appeal it. Despite the fact he had admitted to killing Blessie, he accused investigators of planting evidence, and even claimed that they had stabbed her. He said, "I don't have proof, but I believe those knife wounds were caused by police." He made the astonishing claim that when investigators found Blessie's body, they stabbed her to make it look like she had been alive and moving when stabbed.
I would argue that based on the evidence and opinions of both Dr. Wigren and Dr. Chapman, and the fact that neither could say that the knife wounds alone are what caused the victim's death, the jury could not safely come to the conclusion beyond reasonable doubt that I killed Mrs. Gatenko by inflicting the knife wounds on her. Due to the inconclusive evidence as to the exact cause of death and the opinions given by Dr. Wigren and Dr. Chapman, Dr. Wigren says he thinks it was a combination of all three and says if he were to guess, he would guess the knife wounds are what hastened death. Dr. Chapman's opinion is that there is insufficient evidence to suggest manual strangulation and that the overall mechanism of death remains uncertain. So again, the question, are you sure that Mr. Robertson killed Mrs. Gatenko by inflicting knife wounds on her, cannot be answered 100% beyond reasonable doubt to the standard which is required by the court of law for proof of guilt, when the Crown's own pathologist cannot even tell the court 100% for sure what the exact cause of death was.
The appeal was dismissed. As Robertson continued his life sentence, the inquest continued, and the government announced that they were considering rules around releasing high-risk inmates such as Robertson. The independent inquest would ultimately agree with the inquest held by the Corrections Department. They cleared both the corrections and the police of any major failings, but they made 27 recommendations, which included spending more time getting inmates to do rehabilitation programs, reviewing responses of data sharing, of electronic monitoring alerts, giving more resources to finding high-risk inmates' accommodation following their release, and more training. It crushed Blessy's family, and Antonio released a statement.
Good afternoon. Thank you all for coming. My family and I are both disappointed and devastated by the inquiry's findings. Having reviewed the report and all the evidence at trial, we remain firmly of the view that the Department of Corrections' ineptitude enabled the evil killer to take our Blessy. It is glaringly obvious to us and the wider public that they do not have the capability to manage these high-risk sex offenders. In fact, I think the offenders manage them. How this was not investigated by the report astounds us. We are now going to regroup and think about next steps in our journey for justice for Blessy. Thank you for your time, and please respect our family's privacy at this difficult time.
In the wake of Blessy's murder, Antonio left New Zealand and never came back. He was genuinely lost without his wife, and the memories of the life they had carved out for themselves in New Zealand was far too raw. He said that he missed the simple things, like holding his wife's hand. While the family still loved New Zealand, Blessy's murder had completely shattered the sanctity of the country. And this was shattered even further when the inquest found that police and corrections had done everything possible following Robertson's release. For years, violence and destruction had followed Tony Robertson wherever he went. After being released from prison after 8 years, in no way was he rehabilitated. In fact, when he was released, his violence only increased, and it increased to an exponential level. Robertson had been given a second chance at life after he abducted a little girl, but this was something he denied Blessy Gatenko when he mowed her down, bundled her into his car, and unleashed what could only be described as one of the most vicious attacks that New Zealand had ever seen. Well, besties, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, a massive thank you for listening. I'd also like to say a big thank you to my lovely new Patreon supporters, Michelle, Regis, and George. Morbidology is a one-woman podcast, and the support on Patreon seriously goes such a long way. Please do check it out if you want exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus, ad-free and early release episodes, bonus content, including audio, videos, and case files, and much more. You can join for as little as $1 a month, and there are absolutely no obligations. You can cancel any time. I'd also like to say sorry if my voice sounds a bit weird this week. I've recently had a cold, and my voice isn't back to 100%, so sorry if it sounds a bit nasally. Also remember to check us out at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.